IsraelScene.com.
And you're listening to IsraelScene.com, and I'm Steve.
And this is Yoram.
And we're here together for another episode of the Steve and Yoram Show.
Onwards, onwards.
So what do we have in store for today?
We are experiencing a ceasefire in Lebanon now for a number of days, maybe even a week. I have a hard time telling time. And everybody here is making some kind of concluding remarks and sum-uppings, changing the government, throwing this one out, throwing the other one out. This person was at fault, that person was at fault. And I thought maybe we should do our version, which would entail my saying to you, Steve, how do you think things worked out in this Lebanon experience, which I actually don't think was a Lebanon war. I think it was the war with Hezbollah.
It was a war with Hezbollah, and Hezbollah was a parasite on Lebanon with passive support of the Lebanese government, became a Lebanese war by default. It depends on what day you catch me. Do I feel that how this war has played out for us and for Lebanese?
I think that's a very prevalent feeling. I was at an event a few nights ago at the YMCA in Jerusalem that was sponsored by a group called Media Line, I think. They're the Middle East Press Club, and there were a number of journalists from various media here in Israel who covered the war. And one of them, Danny Rubenstein from Haaretz, said that up until the day before that, which was when Nasrallah made his statement that he had made a mistake in attacking Israel, Rubenstein thought that that Hezbollah had won. But after Nasrallah's statement, he decided that Olmert had won. So it's almost like a changing by the moment. People's perceptions keep switching back and forth, which it makes this very unusual event, because usually we're very sure that we've won.
Well, I think this is because this is an unconventional war. I think that the way in which you're able to measure how successful you were is different to previous wars. You know, if countries fighting against each other, the one that was massacred first usually was the one who lost. It's not so simple now, and also because it's sponsored terrorism by proxy, it makes it a little more difficult. And I'm not so sure about winning or losing as I am events foreseen or unforeseen as a result of the dynamic that took place in Lebanon is possibly proving at this moment in time to be good for Lebanon, in spite of what they say, because they're taking control of their own destiny with the support and pressure from outside forces. And I don't talk about the UN, because the UN is only a pressure for corruption, as I see it. But I think because of America and the European countries, and underneath the radar, the many Arab countries, of forcing Lebanon to take Hezbollah in tow and pushing Syria back to the border to once again for Lebanon to take control of its borders and empower itself to be once again a sovereign state. I think that has or is in process of happening. We don't know what's going to happen. As we know from day to day, anything can happen here in the Middle East. But I think that's so far, for me, a positive sign. I also think what's wonderful for us here, in spite of the terrible loss of life here in Israel, that we are re-examining ourselves in terms of the military, in terms of the political arena, the social arena, which is very important, because we, as we discussed earlier today, I feel that democracy can make us very lazy as a people, regardless where in Europe. We can see the laziness there and the treachery of terrorism. And in America, because things are so easy in one sense, it's really easy to become lazy. And we have too suffered from that here, I believe. And as a result, being Jews and being Israeli, being the state of Israel, with majority of Jews, the rest of the world does not let us forget about who we are. In regard to that, I have something that you haven't seen yet that I found from littlegreenfootballs.com, which actually was a small commentary by Melanie Phillips, who also has a website called melaniephillips.com. That's MelaniePhillips.com. And she asks the question about the media war against Israel and why. So I want to take a little clip from that, because it's really very interesting. She says, the big answer is that Western media transmit the lies of Hezbollah because they want to believe them. And that's because the big lie these media tell and have themselves been told about Israel and its place in history and the world today has achieved the status of an unchallengeable truth. The plain fact is that Western journalists were sent to cover the war being waged against Israel from Lebanon as a war being waged by Israel against Lebanon. And that's because that's how editors think of the Middle East. that the whole ghastly mess is driven by Israel's actions and that, therefore, it is only Israel's aggression which is the story to be covered. Thus, history is inverted. Half a century of Jewish victimization is erased from public consciousness, and victims are turned into aggressors and genocidal mass murderers turned into victims, and the ignorance and prejudice stalk England's once staunch and stalwart land. That's why the fact that hundreds of thousands of refugees from the north of Israel fled to the shelter of strangers in the south, and that within one-third of Israel, those too poor or old or handicapped or disadvantaged to seek refuge elsewhere were forced to live in the shelters for a month in great hardship. That entire economy of northern Israel was effectively shut down for a month, and that thousands of rockets were fired at northern Israel, hundreds every day, many times more than were daily fired at Britain during the Blitz. That's why none of this was reported in Britain, whereas a result, such facts, when now related, were received with open-mouthed astonishment, because journalists were told to ignore it all since that wasn't the story their editors wanted. Israel's victimization simply was not, could not be the story. The only story was Israel's aggression. But that story is a big lie, so the host of lies were transmitted to support it.
I also, Steve, you know Melanie Griffith, is that her name, Melanie?
Melanie Phillips.
Melanie Phillips also coined the term Londonistan in talking about the Islamic infiltration into the city of London. And it also had to do with the Honorable Lord Mayor of London, who we know is a great friend of the
Hezbollah
and Hamas, etc.
Well, speaking about the Muslim world, I just want to change subject just very, very briefly about our ex-president Jimmy Carter of the United States.
Jimmy.
Good old Jimmy, peanuts and all.
Peanut president.
And the Iran fiasco. Anyway, I just find it very interesting. I hope our listeners, those who may be sympathetic to him, will at least Google Jimmy Carter and Arab funding and see that a lot of his criticism of Israel, which has been consistent for years, may have something to do with the fact that his nonprofit organization is heavily funded by Arab money. Not to say that that would influence his positions in any way, but I just find it curious that a lot of money from Saudi Arabia and from individual Arabs in the Middle East fund his propaganda machine. I mean his nonprofit organization. That said and done.
I know that there's a lot of antagonism towards the peanut farmer himself. I remember him fondly for having initiated some very, very fine legislation dealing with energy saving in the United States, with insulating homes, with double pane windows, tax credits for people who did those things to their homes or built homes according to those standards. And I always felt that that was one of his great accomplishments, and for which he should be or could be eternally remembered for good, as we say in Rosh Hashanah.
I know a lot of anti-Semites who most probably go home to their children and their families and treat them really well and do nice good things too. That doesn't still preclude the fact that they're anti-Semites.
Nor does it their being anti-Semites preclude the fact that he may have. Speaking of this subject, by the way, Thomas Friedman had a very interesting article in the New York Times, which I was not successful in downloading, so that I can't quote it, in which he talks about the imperative to reduce the dependency on foreign oil and energy in the United States, partly as a not only in terms of global warming and the whole scientific issue, but as a way of reducing the economic power of countries like Iran, who spend hundreds of millions of dollars supporting Hezbollah, the hundreds of million dollars coming from the United States, from the American economy in the form of payment for gas for oil, and the degree to which he is able to support himself, Iran is able to support itself vis-a-vis its own population by importing and subsidizing vast amounts of consumer goods and food in order to keep their population happy, even though their population may not be completely aligned with the Islamic Republic, and that is in large part because of the high cost of energy and the wasteful use of energy, particularly in the United States, of course, also in Western Europe and in Israel too. Although we don't get our oil from Iran, we get our oil from Egypt. But here too, there's a lot of wasted energy, and that would be an imperative towards in our struggle vis-a-vis the Iranians and the nuclear threat and all those things. And There was an article by a Jerusalem Post journalist op-ed who also brings this issue to the fore and claims in an interesting twisty turn that that is a subject that many of the Jews, liberal Jews in America who have become less than friendly to Israel could be brought back in to the Jewish Israel Zionist fold by an emphasis on, because those are people who also are ecologically minded, that those kind of people could come back into the to the community through that doorway of a strong lobby and a strong effort on the part of the American Jewish community to institute to call for large energy saving in the United States, and the idea of doing it within the community. I mean, I really believe that all of that begins with each of us individually in our homes using less electricity, using less energy, and in all of its various forms, and even in our institutions, the synagogues and Jewish community centers could be more aware and spend more time checking their own usage of electricity, their own usage of energy, and doing what they can to reduce it.
I'm sure we could be more frugal, all of us, in how we use the resource. However, that's not essentially the problem. The problem is that we need to find alternative sources of energy. We have to fight the transportation lobby and the oil lobby in terms of getting them off their lazy arses and really bringing to the forefront so much alternative use, which they've been R&Ding for God knows how many years. Oil was too cheap and they were making too much money and it was too easy to make any major changes, which I think also has to be done and done as quickly and as rapidly as possible. But, you know, there was a sidebar to this that Russia, is now with their reorganization of their oil cartel and ex-KGB Putin, now president of Putin of Russia, since he consolidated all of the cartel there, is now producing more oil than Saudi Arabia. So it's the largest producer of oil in the world today.
Well, he's no bargain either.
He is absolutely no bargain.
I mean, he's the one who's selling at bargain prices a lot of the rockets, a lot of the technology to the Iranians, to the North Koreans, to the Syrians. You know, a bunch of years ago, the claim was made here that we no longer needed a strong military presence on the Golan because the Syrian army was no longer effective and Syria was broke and there was nobody to subsidize them like the Soviet Union had. And their tanks weren't working and their airplanes weren't worth anything. So, you know, we could cross them off the list as a potential danger. Now it turns out, a few years later, that the Russians have figured out that they can extend to the Syrians a long line of credit. The Iranians are willing to pick up part of the credit. The Saudis are willing to pick up part of the credit. So the continued efforts, the continued manifestation of Russia as Russia or Russia as the Soviet Union to our against us in this part of the world is an ongoing affair. And back to Mr. the peanut farmer, is that part of what he was doing when he was stimulating the use of energy saving devices in the home was he was in a way underwriting the continued attempts to develop more energy-saving devices and alternative forms of energy.
Yeah, unfortunately, he spent more energy trying to do that and less energy trying to release the American hostages in Iran.
Well, okay, so we're not going to like him no matter what he did.
No, not particularly.
No, we're not. Okay. So we've taken care of him, yes. And what else is left?
God, so much power we
don't
have.
Don't you feel good, Steve?
I feel
you get
great.
To get it, your mouth on that microphone and lay it down on a former president of the United States and his library.
I've
I think that's what
to
they
him.
Do.
He's never written
did you?
Back. Yes.
Well,
I
told you, I found a letter I wrote to Mubarak, and Mubarak did write back. Okay.
Did write back.
Onward. So you were quoting this English woman.
Yes, about how the media is essentially shaping, framing the interest in the Israeli Middle East situation. Basically, see and have framed the interest in Israel being the aggressor, and all the other Arab states being the victims.
Let me jump in for a second here at this event in Jerusalem. The media event, one of the statements that was made is that the editors back in the headquarters. In this case, it was made by the gentleman from the New York Times, so that's the headquarters in New York, was to report on the war as a human interest story rather than as a political story, rather than as a story of the struggle between the West and the Islamists. But it's a human interest story. It's not about the war against terrorism.
Yeah, that's so disingenuous. I mean, a human interest story. There's a war being fought. And this whole cluster bomb nonsense. Well, of course they use cluster bombs. We're not saying we didn't use cluster bombs. The issue is, what did we use the cluster bombs to do? And that was to knock out areas that Hezbollah was heavily concentrated in and to be able to do the job. This is a war. And I just find it so... I'm so amazed by the fact that we're unwilling, although certainly the press is unwilling to view it as such, but they have their own personal agendas. In Lebanon, they feared for their lives. They were controlled by Hezbollah as what information they got to see. And the dishonest reporting in terms of showing a small section of southern Beirut bombed out, that's not in the interests of the editors of the major news organizations. And thank God for bloggers, because they now have a voice with a new generation of decentralization of information, which I think is crucial for this new world that is obsessed with information. And I think that this is where we're, I think, headed. I think the big news organizations have had their day. Certainly the printed press waste so many trees. Can you imagine? Sooner than later, maybe in our lifetime, there will be no longer this gigantic 10-pound newspaper that I was such a young kid in the Bronx schlepping into the house. Although I don't remember my parents ever reading the New York Times. Maybe it was in my imagination. Because everything's going to be electronic. Everything's going to be on the internet. You may pay for it if you'd so desire. But I think the decentralization of news is crucial.
I wanted to mention there have been a number of very interesting issues brought up in this period after the conflict. Issues of who's to blame and how we should deal with it. There's a large group here in Israel, particularly of people who were demobilized after the war, reserve soldiers and even soldiers in the regular army, but mostly on the part of the reserve soldiers who were, by and large, already adults, people with families and educations and jobs and mature people rather than the youngsters that the 18-year-olds that more or less typify the regular army, those who are doing their original 3 years of service. The main call now, and it's sort of a non-negotiable. It's presented as a non-negotiable issue. I'm hoping when I get back up to Jerusalem to interview the people involved, and then we'll have it directly from them and not secondhand. Is that the Prime Minister Olmert and the Minister of Defense, Amir Peretz, and the Chief of the General Staff, Dan Chalutz, should all resign. And as I say, that appears to be a non-negotiable demand on their part. And then I don't know if they've really thought much about what happens next.
Well, certainly a number of generals in today's paper, the Post had stated that many of the generals... Former reserve generals have demanded or asked for Halutz's head, that Halutz leave, resign, and bring in new fresh blood, so to speak.
I would like to remind people about Dan Chalutz. He was the first one. One of the things that was so unusual about his appointment and that had people confused and awakened by it is that he did not have, as far as I know, a history in the ground forces, in the infantry, the tanks, the commandos, or even the military intelligence, which has been the tradition of the source of chiefs of the general staff. His military service was in the Air Force, and one of the reasons that he was brought in the subtext, obviously not in public, was because of the feeling that the next real battle was going to be with Iran, and it was going to be fought by the Air Force. So that's part of the reason that he came into the General Staff as the chief of the General Staff. And as we all know, the next war, in fact, was a ground war, and there was every attempt to use the Air Force to decide the war or to fight the war. Now is common knowledge that the Air Force in the first half hour, very much like the Six-Day War, that in the first half hour, 45 minutes of the war, destroyed basically all of Hezbollah's ability to fire long-range rockets south of Haifa, good old Tel Aviv and Herzliya and the rest of the country, which would have put another million or 2 million people in the bomb shelters. And that didn't happen because the Air Force destroyed his launchers and his missiles. So that much the Air Force accomplished?
I think they accomplished an awful lot. I think they really knocked, did tremendous damage to the infrastructure that was necessary for Hezbollah to continue in a coordinated effort. I think that they were knocked out for the most part, in spite of what some of the press said up north, that they knocked out most of the main lines from Syria into Lebanon, resupplying Hezbollah. I think that they did a tremendous job in providing cover to the forces, even though maybe there wasn't a decisive blow. And just as Olmert said a couple of days ago, he's walking around free. Nasrallah is still hiding out somewhere. You know, I mean, good old Reverend Jesse Jackson, who made his whirlwind tour of the Middle East to see if he could solve something. God knows he's never solved anything. It's taken a lot of money from a lot of organizations.
I'm interested more in Dan Chalutz and what happens to the Israeli military. The problem with Dan Chalutz, people felt, was that from his position as the commander, the former commander of the Air Force, and his years of experience in the Air Force, that the reliance on the Air Force doing the job was too strong, there was too much of that. And as a result, it took so long for the ground forces to go into play that there was not the opportunity for the total victory that many people felt we need in order to give ourselves some breathing time. Because the other thing that's going on is that everybody here is talking about a second round. So this is now a very...
So it's when, not if.
It's a when. And people are very aware that this is... that there will be a second round, and it will be relatively soon, and that we don't have a whole lot of time to prepare for it and to get our act together and to repair the mistakes that were made. And part of the mistakes and part of the repair evidently does need to be in the area of the leadership. Personally, I despise Ehud Olmert from the days before he was mayor of Jerusalem. His days as mayor of Jerusalem increased my feeling of despisal for him. And I'm not a fan of his as the prime minister. However, one of the real problems, and this has been mentioned by a number of people, is that the whole leadership cadre in this country has very little depth. There's very few people after Olmert who are really capable of running the country. Not that Olmert's particularly capable, but the alternatives to him are even worse. And I think in terms of Bibi Netanyahu, and I think that his Russian sidekick is also going to benefit greatly. The whole right-wing element, the whole right-wing side of our political world here is going to increase in strength as a result of this war. And I don't think that will really do us any good in terms of the struggles that lie before us. Because the right-wing side, while it has a solid attitude, and it has an attitude towards our enemies, they also have a very solid attitude towards our economics and towards those who are weaker and who can't succeed in this society. And that's, I think, a very dangerous one, and one that does not do us any good. I also wanted to mention, people might have heard a lot about the Shaba Farms. Should we return it? Should we give it to the Lebanese? And that was one of the justifications of Hezbollah for fighting us, is that after we withdrew from Lebanon. I'd like to remind everybody that when we withdrew and we built the fence between us and Lebanon, that the United Nations surveyors came with GPS systems and made sure that we were on the international border, and in some cases the fence had to be moved, you know,
a foot or so,
2 feet, 5 feet, this way or that way, in order to be 100% by the GPS system on the line. One of the interesting part of that is of the countries bordering Lebanon, of which there are only two, we and Syria, we are the only country that accepts the Lebanese international boundary, which is one of the bases of the issues of the Shaba Farms. The Shaba Farms were captured not from Lebanon, but from Syria in the 1967 war. So now the game is to claim that they actually belong to Lebanon. Okay. Now, if they actually belong to Lebanon, there needs to be some kind of an agreement between Syria and Lebanon that those belong to Lebanon. And that was part of the ploy that was going to be used in order to for us to be pushed into returning them, to giving them back. To giving them, not to giving them back, but to giving them to Lebanon in the first place.
And we also know that Syria really has never accepted the Lebanese boundaries because it sees Lebanon as really part of Greater Syria.
As it sees Jordan, Israel,
yes,
and quote-unquote Palestine,
yes,
as a part of Syria, which is a historical anomaly, but one that the Syrians continue to take very seriously.
Even though they have also been artificially created.
Right. I mean, all of this in here is a very free-flowing area. The under the Ottomans, who were the occupiers here for hundreds of years, 400 or 500 years, what today we call Syria, Lebanon, Jordan, Israel, Palestine, was one large Ottoman county. And the county seat was in Damascus. And only with the coming of, at the end of World War I, in the 1920s, here in 1920 itself, I believe, when the English and the French divided up the spoils here, was that county divided into four, which is a very interesting story on its own. Part of it was became Syria, part Lebanon, part Jordan, part Palestine. The Syrians still don't accept that, and the Syrians still see all of that as part of their as part of Syria. So that when they were faced with the proposition to sign off on the Shaba Farms area, give it or make it part of Lebanon, which would then force Israel to relinquish it, they couldn't bring themselves to sign the paper. I don't know if you've been in the position of somebody demanding that you agree to something and you really want to because it'll help you in some way, but you can't go that line. I remember Arafat, one of the agreements with Arafat, he wouldn't sign, I think it was in Cairo, and he couldn't sign the paper, not that it made a whole big difference.
His hand started to shake.
Right, and they had to take him in the back room, Mubarak took him in the back room and browbeat
him. Stoned
him
or something.
And, you know, worked him over so that he would sign this agreement. And this is what happened between Lebanon and Syria on the issue of the Shaba Farms. And it's still an unfinished business. And it'll remain in the news for years to come, which is one of the reasons I thought it was worth taking the time to explain a little bit about it and why it is such a conflicted issue. The other reason it's conflicted is that it sits in a place which gives it a good view, both to the north, which is Lebanon, and to the south, which is into Israel. So it has a significant strategic importance, which is one of the reasons that the Lebanese so much would like to have it in their hands rather than it being in our hands, because it gives us a certain advantage over them in the area that's known as southern Lebanon.
So at this point in time, you're listening to IsraelScene.com, we sit in a place of great transition, both in Lebanon and in Israel, in terms of the social, political, and military dynamics. We hope and pray that it works out for all concerned.
I did want to add that there were two other characters who are on the line here to lose their jobs, to be replaced. The other two is the Minister of Defense, Amir Peres.
Excuse me? You hear the crowd applauding?
For or against?
Against.
Against.
You must admit that the guy is a bit of a petty tyrant.
I think he was snookered into taking this job.
It was
well a job
done.
That he was certainly not qualified for, didn't have any real feel for. I think he did the best he could under the circumstances. I mean, he certainly didn't expect to have to be a wartime Minister of Defense within a month or two of taking on the job. But I think he's not the right person. Personally, I'm not sure if the right person at this point would be a general, an ex-general, or somebody whose area of expertise was finance.
You could have a general who has economic
background. That would be an ideal combination, because I think the real issue that we're facing now is that there are so many demands. There's so much that needs to be fixed, and all of it requires money, that both the Minister of Defense and potentially even the Chief of the General Staff need to be people who will really understand economics, understand where money is being wasted, and there is money being wasted. all large institutions of that size and be able to get rid of the waste and to put the money where it needs to be, because there is crying need to refill the storage facilities. There's crying need to upgrade the Army, to call on the reserves to spend more time training, which is very expensive, to call on the Air Force to spend more time training. It costs thousands of dollars an hour to fly these planes around. I mean, it's like, you know, you look at them and they, whoosh, there it goes, and it comes back and forth and it makes a lot of noise and it looks real easy. But all of those machines are very expensive to maintain. The only way you can maintain those airplanes is by replacing the parts before they go wrong, because once they go wrong, you lose the whole airplane. So those parts have to be constantly replaced by the hour. Certain number of hours you replace this, a number of hours you replace that. Not only does it take time for people to be doing that, but the parts themselves are expensive. The gasoline, I can't imagine how many thousands of tons of fuel were used in this one's month's worth of war, you know, between the tanks and the planes and the trucks to bring the reservists here and the APCs and all the mechanical, the machinery. There's a tremendous amount of material being used, and all that material has to be bought. We don't really produce any of it. The shells, all of that shooting, all those big guns, those and the bombs, those things run around 3,000 shekels
apiece.
War is costly.
War is definitely costly.
And rebuilding everything that needs to be rebuilt is going to be very costly. So I think part of what we really need here are people who really understand economics and know where the money is hiding, where the bureaucracy hides the money that's superfluous, and be able to get there, take the money out, and put it where it belongs.
I agree.
Was this IsraelScene.com?
This is IsraelScene.com. And again, the show goes too fast. Wow, it's that time again.
But we do have a forum that people are invited to participate in.
Please, please, please. It's an exciting part of the website now, and we want more people to just sign on and make your comments. And let us know that you're out there.
Perhaps, Steve, we also need to pledge again that the information that is used in the signing on to the forum will not be used, will not be shared, will not leave the confines of the server for any purpose other than the purpose of the forum, than the purpose of IsraelScene.com.
We have no desire to do that. We really...
And nobody's come and asked us to do
no,
that.
No, and we'll never do that, because that's not who we are and what we're about. We're interested in hearing from you, and we want to know who you are, and it helps us to see how we need to alter or change things if necessary, or to bring in other kinds of viewpoints in here in order to make this as interesting to our listeners as possible. So again, I really strongly... request that you join the forum, that you make your voices heard here on our website, and we'll try the best we can to make our programs as interesting as possible. I want to also thank Nir, who has done all of the jingles and music for us, the outgoing music, and Rubisol. Rubisol.
Rebbe.
I know, but wasn't Rubber Soul by the Beatles, actually?
Right, well, it's not quite on it.
No.
I mean, I think he is, but he isn't.
Well, so Rebbe Soul,
who
did his rendition of Hatikva, which we use also.
And his CD, he has a website, RebbeSoul.com, Soul, S-O-U-L, has a number of very nice renditions of Jewish, Hebrew, Israeli music in his unique style. Recommended.
Yes, and Omer and Tal from GolanArts.com, who have been constantly working on the website and constantly improving it, making it more user-friendly. And with that, this is Steve.
And this is still Yoram.
And we wish you all a Shavua Tov, a great week, and you're listening to IsraelScene.com.